Good afternoon. So I'm glad to have the opportunity to share with you some of the recent ideas we have on the origins of ultra-low velocity zones. And Michael has already told me we encourage questions, especially from junior participants and from people who are not mineral physicists. And I noticed that my color on my computer has been transformed into different color. The olivine-rich upper mantle has turned gray here. It is green on my computer. Another unusual thing is, even before I started my talk, I already got a question. Connelly came to me asking me about the reactions over here. So I showed an arrow here without balancing the number of atoms here, a redox state. So in principle, you would have three Fe2+, and then it will produce two Fe3+ plus one metallic iron. So if you do want to do balance out the reaction, I did not do that. So please note that these reactions are not balanced. So before I get started, I want to acknowledge this is part of a PhD thesis work by Dr. Jiaqiao Liu, who is now still working as a postdoc, but will be moving on to another institute pretty soon. And the two research scientists at the APS and affiliated with Carnegie, we also have a number of people who provided very helpful reviews: Michael Water, Alan McNamara, Terry Plank, and Dave Walker. I want to thank them for their contribution. So at the CIDR, I think the discussion of ULVZs and LLSVPs have been ongoing for many years. And for most people who do not think about these things, one important thing to point out is that LLSVP, these are the main features you see, the blue and red. They are very large-scale structures. That's why they are called province, large low shear wave velocity province. And the ULVZ, in comparison, they are tiny. So these are the little yellow things over here you see. That's ULVZ. ULVZ is ultra-low velocity zone. So ultra-low velocity in the sense that the shear wave reduction is on the order of 30%, much more than LLSVP, which is only low shear velocity, maybe reduction up to, on average, probably a few percent. And this is an ultra-low velocity zone. A zone means it's very small. So the extent of the ultra-low velocity zone, on average, the height is about 5 to 30 kilometers. Unlike the LLSVP, it goes all the way up more than 1,000 kilometers in height. And the lateral extent, typically for ULVZ, is about 100 kilometers. And the LLSVP, again, thousands of kilometers. I want to note that some studies, for instance, by Kotal and Romanovich, Barbara, they found some occasionally very unusual ULVZ that can go as broad as 900 kilometers, but those are not typical. So the features of ULVZ: VS reduction, shear wave reduction, about 30%, VP reduction about 10%. That's just on average. They are a wide range. For instance, Dan Frost told me, he showed a slide that has the VS reduction up to 50% at certain places. And the density excess is about 5 to 15%. And Quentin William, he also pointed out that we have very limited constraints on density. So there are only a few places density measurements are really available. And in terms of distribution, these ULVZs in general, they are associated with the LLSVP, but not strictly. So the distribution is still kind of not very well mapped out. So these features have been known for more than 20 years. And they are interesting because they potentially can provide really important, unique insights into the thermochemical state of the base of the mantle. Because the first thing is, these features, they are not ubiquitous. So they are isolated patches distributed here and there. So that indicates chemical heterogeneity at the base of the mantle. Here is a distribution map of the ULVZ, where the blue shows where they looked for ULVZ and did not find those. And the red shows where people looked and found ULVZ, those special zones. So because ULVZs have lower VSVP, they tell us something about the thermal structure and the chemical state. So if you look at this equation, shear velocity is shear modulus divided by density square root. So if you want to lower the VS, the most effective way is to melt the sample. If you have a melt, it doesn't support shear. The VS would vanish altogether. And another way is to have an area enrichment, which is going to increase the density. So even if the shear velocity stays the same, density goes up, shear velocity is going to go down. So this reduction in Vs indicates either melting and or iron enrichment. So that will indicate this. And Vs, Vp is somewhat similar because here we have the shear modulus on the numerator and we have density in the denominator. So that's what velocity can tell us. And density is relatively straightforward because we have density equals to mass divided by volume. And in general, if you replace magnesium with iron, it's not going to change volume very much. But density is definitely going to go up because iron has much higher atomic number. It's 56 versus magnesium, 24. So as a rule of thumb, if you have any 1 atomic percent of iron replacing magnesium, the density is going to increase by about 1%. That's the general kind of conception. So these kind of things are interesting because we want to know what they are telling us about what's going on at the base of the mantle. So currently, there are 3 type of hypotheses to explain the ULVZ. One of the earlier and still going on popular hypotheses is partially molten silicate. So these are the number of studies since 96, and then followed by more recent studies proposing ULVZ produced through partial melting of silicate. But there are a couple of issues raised recently. One is that ULVZ is not ubiquitous. That means if your melting point is too low, you're going to generate a layer of melt, and that's not observed by seismic observations. So these are the an image from Nomura science paper showing that if you had a solidus, this is solidus of pyrolite, and these are solidus and liquidus of a pyridotite. And what you can see here is the geotherm, if it's listed here, these studies, the solidus would be too high, nothing will melt, therefore you cannot generate partial melt, no ULVZ. And if you had this solidus, different composition, then you're going to be so much on the geotherm that you probably will generate a layer of melt. As a result, that's also not consistent with seismic observation. So the melting temperature has to be just right to generate the right amount of melt in order to be consistent with observation. That's one challenge this type of models are facing. And then because of this, it was proposed that hydrogen probably needs to be in the core. The reason is if you have hydrogen in the core, then you can lower the melting temperature in the core so that the solidus is still above the core temperature or the actual temperature. Therefore, you don't end up with a layer of melt, which is not observed. And another issue with this type of model is you have to produce enough density excess. And then there are a couple of studies showing that if you produce this kind of density excess through basal magma ocean, if you crystallize basal magma ocean, leave behind some liquid, that liquid is not dense enough. That's the study by Thomas et al. Another study showed if you just have assembly, you partially melt it, this total assembly, the density is not going to change unless the melt can go somewhere else and interact with some iron-rich component to enrich iron. Then you can generate some excess in density. So the density excess is another challenge that these kind of models are facing. So if you have any questions, feel free to interrupt me. Because Michael told me the talk itself is about 20 minutes and we have 10 minutes for discussion. We can discuss now or later. Feel free to interrupt if anything is not clear. Yes.
So, Jackie, can you say it again, please? So you said that if you partially melt part of your silicate, the density will not change.
If you partially melt, what happens is the melt in general will be enriched in iron. So the melt is going to be a little bit denser. But when you look at the ULVZ, it's not totally melted. If it's totally melted, the shear velocity would be zero. So you need to have an assembly with solid matrix with some melt in it. And if the melt and the solid is still within its own framework, the total density is not going to change very much. Unless the melt can move somewhere else, so then it will have an iron enrichment in it. There's another question in the back.
So some study shows that the Vp reduction and the Vs reduction, they have a ratio of 1 to 3.
That's right.
Will the partial melt theory explain these ratios between them?
Yeah, that's a very good question. In fact, the partial melt model did not even get to the point of addressing this point. But the other model, which is I'm showing next, did try to address this issue of this relative change in VS versus VP has to be a ratio of 3, right? What you said is the other way around, the DVP dealing VS is 1 to 3. So this is another type of model which says I don't need melt. All I need is iron enrichment. If I have solid enriched in iron, experiment shows that iron not only increases density but also reduces shear velocity. So that's the work by Mao et al. On post-Bridgmanite, post-perovskite, and Wicks et al. They showed in oxide ferropericlase, if you have iron enrichment, both density and shear velocity, shear modulus will go down. Therefore, it provides a potential solution to explain the ULVZ. And recently, there are a couple of studies from Moore and Broadhold. They showed that these studies at room temperature, the measurement at room temperature through experiments, they did not consider temperature effect on the velocities. These are a couple of theoretical studies, calculations. So they were able to account for temperature effects. So they look at a different temperature. So this is a VP versus density plot. Here is VS versus density plot. And what is shown over here, the squares, the solid squares, these are observed ULVZ. And here are different isotherms. And these dotted lines is actually bound for isotherm at 4,000. So because you have aggregate, you want to have a void bound and a Royce bound. So this is the bounds on this. What you can see is you can match VP okay, but VS, none of these curves really match VP, even given the large error bars. So this is one of the challenges that these studies revealed for this type of model, iron-enriched solid. What they propose is any single phase, either ferropericlase or bridgmanite or post-bridgmanite, won't work. But they said if you can combine different phases together with appropriate geometry, you might be able to reproduce the features. That definitely the key is to reproduce this ratio, because the ratio seemed to be a more robust feature than the absolute velocity reduction. And another challenge with this kind of model is you have to generate some kind of iron enrichment that is localized. Because if you want to supply iron to this solid through a reaction with the core, for instance, why should it be focused on certain spots and not everywhere, right? This is one of the challenges that this model has to face. So this is the second type of model. They also have some problems. And then we have the third type of model. We all know from the seismic, the shadow zone, the core is metallic. And the metallic core has basically no shear velocity. Shear velocity is zero. No shear capabilities, no way to support shear. And the density is very high. So several people considered the possibility that ULVZ might be linked to metallic melt. And these are the studies, for instance, the very early study already mentioned this possibility. There are a number of other studies. They are not really looking at the ULVZ specifically. They are more interested in trying to explain the coupling between the mantle and the core, which leads to length of day variation and other signature. And then in the paper, they would mention ULVZ. So can this metallic melt explain ULVZ? But the problem is, the core metal, if it's in the core, it's very dense. It has to come up to the mantle in order to produce the ULVZ. And how can they come up? So one way people think about it is the capillary rise. But in the core, at core pressure, 130 GPa, the pressure is very high. You have grain boundaries, but you don't have any cracks. So for the things to come out, it has to go through some defects. The grain boundaries are defects in the structure, and it has to go through reaction, chemical reaction. And that reaction rate is rather limited. So Poirier et al., they estimated the capillary rise. They said that rise of core melt up to the mantle is limited to only 20 meters through geological time. That is simply not enough, because the ULVZ, we're talking about 5 to 30 kilometers. And another study by Kanda Stevenson, they come up with some kind of suction mechanism. What they do is they have the deviatory stress going on at the base of the mantle, and then somehow it creates a suction process. they estimated that this kind of process over geological time can bring core material up by about 1 kilometer. That is still too short for the UOVZs. So this third type of model still have problems. Yes?
But for example, if you have a global layer of 1 kilometer, then the global layer can form into piles, small piles with very thick piles. Yeah.
That's a very good point, yes. So I think that's a point that they haven't considered, whether you can accumulate these things into folded up, and then you can double up, and then, right, and you can probably generate 5 kilometer, 30 kilometer if you are able to concentrate that melt together. So I'm going to present something that's actually along the same line, except for the metallic melt in our models, they don't come from the core. They come from the mantle, but it's still metallic melt. So this kind of idea comes from the recent studies showing, this study is a little bit earlier, which has been presented by Catherine when she talked about how the lower mantle has a lot of Fe3+, but is reduced, this kind of apparent contradiction, right? Because you have these so-called disproportionation reaction. When you have the bridgmanite, the 2+, the divalent iron in bridgmanite, it can disproportionate into metallic iron and trivalent Fe3+. That's because the crystal structure really favors the energy of Fe3+ in the Bridgman structure is very low. So the structure likes to take this. As a result, Fe2+ will become unstable and disproportionate. So you can generate metallic iron in the lower mantle. And more recently, Rohrbach et al., this is a ETH group, they found that this kind of reaction, not only does it happen in bridgmanite in the lower mantle, but it occurs anywhere below 250 kilometers. When you are at that depth, pyroxene and garnet has the same kind of capability to accommodate Fe3+ in the structure. Therefore, you have this reduction happening already at 250 kilometer depth. And if this happens in the subductive slab, you have carbonates. Some carbonates might be able to survive subduction, not coming out right away through volcanism. When they come down, the metallic iron can reduce carbonate and produce carbon, elemental carbon. Maybe this is helpful for generating the diamonds that Barbara's group wants to have. But this depth is a little bit higher, 250 kilometers or higher. So if you have these iron and carbon together, you have iron-carbon binary system. What we want to know is, you can have slabs carry FEC mixture to maybe all the way to Comenda boundary, because we have seen seismic images showing that some slabs go all the way to the base of the mantle. And we also have some additional evidence from diamond inclusions where you do see iron carbide forming. That means you can generate iron and carbon, and maybe they can come together, meet with each other. So we want to investigate what happens to the iron carbon mixture when they go into the deep mantle. And what we did is to do some experiments using diamond anvil cell and laser heating. And the experiments are conducted at Argonne National Lab. And this kind of experiments make use of the recently developed diffuse scattering technique. So last week, we talked about the melting point of iron. Anzalini et al., they used this technique to detect the melting of pure iron. And in this study, we are probably among the first to apply this technique to a binary system, iron-carbon alloy mixture. So here is the image of the sample and the 72 GPA. Here is a X-ray diffraction pattern that shows solid state at this low temperature. When you go to very high temperature, you will see that these very well-defined Debye-Schura rings will become diffuse arcs. So that's indicating melting because the long-range structure has been destroyed because of melting. So we have data like this. I'm not going to go into details here, but I will show you how the data are integrated, and then you see the very rising background. Yes, Dan?
You said you can see that there is melt based on the diffuse rings.
Diffuse
is
scattering.
That just an indication that there is just melt, or is it quantifiable?
Is what? Melt versus?
Is the amount of melt quantifiable, or is it just that there is
melt? Oh, the amount of melt. Yeah, the amount of melt is not as easy to quantify, because in the diamond anvil cell, the system, the environment is very dynamic. You might have melt coming, and it moves away, and then there's probably some mismatch between the laser heating spot and X-ray spot. So we don't really, we're not confident in quantifying the amount of melt. What we do is detect the eutectic melting, the onset of melting in this study. But that's a good question, yes.
So, but do you have an idea how much melt you need to have to start to see?
Yes, we are going to do that next. Very good.
I have a second question. So how do you know that this is not the diffuse scattering due to defects in the lattice, like unharmonicity of the phonons? What tells you that these are a signature of the melt and not just the unharmonicity in the solid, like a pre-melting effect in the solid?
Yeah, I think pre-melting is not going to produce this extensive diffuse scattering. You might have growth of grains, you might have spotty ring that we did observe, but to have a uniform diffuse scattering ring, that we consider a signal of melt. We also have experiments at a relatively low temperature where we have large volume press data to compare with. And then I will show the results next. So this is the results we have. So we have the melting below lower bound and upper bound. This is the curve that established from this experiment. And here we have some other data from multi-envol experiments up to 25 GPA over here. They compare quite well. So that's a kind of a supporting evidence for the method. And then we also have other study from diamond envol cell up to about 70 GPA. So that experiment also is slightly off because they're using different way to detect the melting. Yes, Abby.
Is the melting curve, are those bounds on the solidus or the liquidus?
On the eutectic, it's a solidus. Because this is a eutectic system, so it's a eutectic point we are bounding. Not the full melting, not the liquidus.
And you don't see any Fe7C3?
We have the starting material is a mixture of iron and Fe3C. And we have the melting, and we still have the two solid phase existing, even during melting, because there's still temperature gradient and all these things, right? So we have detected the melting curve over here, and here's the previous up to 70. So that one, using different method, is slightly higher than ours, but we agree with the study within error bar. So this study detect the eutectic melting curve all the way to the Coromandel boundary. So that's the experimental part of the results that the mineral physicists would be more interested in. I think I will go to the interpretation part now. So we have this melting curve over here, and here is the geotherm that we adopted according to Anzalini. What you see over here is that at near the base of the mantle, because of this very steep thermal boundary layer, very steep temperature gradient, this melting, the eutectic melting curve is going to intercept the geotherm at near the base of the mantle. So that indicates that once this iron-carbon mixture gets carried to the base of the mantle, it's going to melt. And it's probably going to melt to different degrees depending on how much excess there is and what is the carbon content. So some detailed analysis going on here. And if you have pure iron, as you can see over here, pure iron without carbon is going to sit above the geotherm, and then it's likely going to remain solid, not going to melt. So the presence of carbon and possibly other light elements has the ability to reduce the melting point and then produce a metallic melt at the base of the mantle. So that's a way to supply metallic melt to the base of the mantle. And Rosman asked a question about how much melt do you need? And that depending on the wetting behavior of this melt. So people probably have seen these kind of behavior, how a liquid could be not welting and not wetting the silicate, or just barely wetting or fully wetting. So this is a 3D image on an iron sulfur system showing in the lower in the upper mantle, the melt would be distributed separately, like trapped in grain among in the matrix. And if you increase pressure enough, the iron sulfur system will start to wet the silicate, and then they're going to form interconnected network. So depending on the wetting behavior, the shear velocity reduction is going to be significantly affected. We are looking at two extreme cases. One is 10 degrees, which means it's wetting, and 80 degrees above the critical value of 60 degrees for dihedral angle is not wetting. We don't really know the behavior, wetting behavior for iron carbon in this lower mantle silicate. So we are assuming these two values. And what you see here is this is the density Vp and Vs. So for density, as I said earlier, it's 1% iron, 1% density increase. It's pretty straightforward. For Vp, it's not very sensitive to the wetting angle or dihedral angle. So whether it's 80 degree or 10 degree, it's a small difference. It's on the order of also about 1% corresponded to 0.5% or 1% Vp reduction. But for Vs, there's a huge difference. If the melt is not wetting the grain boundary, it's going to be trapped. It's not very effective in reducing the Vs, so the curve is relatively shallow. But if it's wetting, it's going to be interconnected, spread out, therefore very effective in reducing the shear velocity, so you get this kind of curve. And what we do is for one of this, for instance, 10 degrees, we're trying to look for a region, the melt fraction, that can simultaneously match the density Vp and Vs. And we found a range for 10 degree, it's about 5 to 11% of melt you need. And for this 80 degree, is another range, is about 9 to 16% volume fraction of melt you need in order to match ULVZ observations. So based on these kind of things, we're proposing three different scenarios. One is the metallic melt is wetting, and you have this, you need this much of melt. They are spread around, so they reduce the shear velocity very effectively. And these kind of melt, again, Ming Li mentioned earlier, you know, we are also starting with about 1% metallic melt in the slab. The slab does not have, you know, that much metallic iron. It's on the order up to 1%. So you do have to concentrate it, maybe through some kind of dynamic process or chemical processes. There are some studies out there by Hernlund and Jelinek and the Kolstad through shear focusing of melt. So there are mechanisms people proposed that could focusing 1% into maybe up to 11, maybe as much as 5%, that's enough. But we do have a percolation threshold. That means if you reach the 5%, this melt is going to form a network and drain down. It's not going to be able to stay in the solid matrix. But there is a way, maybe through viscous stirring. This one is proposed by Hernlund and Jelinek. So these melt, even though they want to drain, but because they are stirred through viscous dragging and so on, they might be able to stay for a while. But eventually, I think in this case, these melts will not be able to remain in the mantle. And then they likely, this kind of EOVZ would likely be short-lived. They have to be actively replenished by subduction. So this is one of the models. Another model is the second case where the melt is not wetting the silicate matrix. So you need more volume percentage of this one because the effectiveness in reducing shear velocity is less. In this case, when you have that much volume fraction, the metallic melt simply cannot stay there. It's going to drain. But there is another possibility that maybe you have a little bit of silicate partial melt. If you have two melts together, the draining threshold is going to be raised. So that's this kind of case where we show the yellow metallic melt together with a little bit partial silicon melt. This one, of course, still require melting temperature to be just right, but it does not no longer require iron enrichment because we're bringing iron through the subduction. And so we showed that the metallic melt alone probably not viable and the silicon melt alone not viable for these reasons. But if you combine this, this is a possibility. I'm about to finish. And then we have the third hypothesis. This one is you can bring these kind of melts over, and then the melt probably react with the ambient solid, and then will lead to iron enrichment in post-bridgmanite and ferropericlase. So this is already a mixture. So you can enrich both phases in iron through this kind of a back reaction. So the iron plus Fe3+ that came out of a bridgmanite, they can back react to recombine into Fe3+ and go back into post-bridgmanite or ferropericlase. And this way they can enrich iron. So this way you can produce isolated patches because the melt delivers iron, so targeted places only where the slab is happening. And then the size is limited by reaction and diffusion rate. If you look at the reaction diffusion rate, the size of this ULVZ will be very limited. And because the diffusion and the reaction are relatively slow, these type of ULVZ are likely to be a little bit thin and relatively tall because they don't really, the melt is not spreading, because it's solid, it's not like melt, it can spread out. So I think this implications I will skip for now, but we want to discuss some implication how this process in the early time could help mix late veneer. And another implication is what many geophysicists have been thinking about, the length of day variation in on the decadal kind of period indicates the core mantle boundary conductive layer, and this kind of metallic melt from the slabs could provide this conductive layer. So here is a conclusion, just this picture again, and then mentioning the model features. We are talking about possibly several different origins, all related to metallic melt that's produced and supplied through subduction. And these kind of models can explain isolated small patches quite well, because slab subduction is not universal. It's in isolated locations. And we are able to quantitatively reproduce all these velocities and the density features of the ULVZ. And in the next steps, we would like to test the models to measure the wetting behavior of this iron carbon melt in the lower mantle minerals. And you know, how do we concentrate this melt so that you can reach this kind of volume fraction? Also to quantify or understand the diffusion reaction rate to see how, you know, the different models, what time scale can these kind of features be produced and sustained. So that's my talk. Thank you for your attention.
So we observe different kinds ULVZs in different locations and different shapes and geometries. And in this final cartoon, you have the different geometries, as explained by, different geometries with different hypotheses. So do you think there are multiple hypotheses also all possible and all occurring at the same time?
I think so. But they're not mutually exclusive. At this point, I think ULVZ might have a diverse range of origins. And these are just some of the possibilities, right? They don't have to be all the same. Because as long as they share the same common feature of some partial melt, reduced velocity, and some iron enrichment to increase density.
Yes. Jackie, you relate this to subduction, and maybe I haven't followed all the details of that, but could you also do it from the magma ocean?
Magma ocean. I don't know. How do you do it through magma ocean? You mean leftover iron, incomplete core formation, or
droplets?
Droplets from the magma ocean, but that's still incomplete core formation. You think some of the core forming alloy have not managed to fully segregate. I think that's possible, except for that process is time limited. Subduction is ongoing, right? So I was looking for, we thought one of the unique features is this subduction, you know, supplies the iron alloys actively nowadays. So even if these metallic melt are not stable, they drain to the core, we can still replenish through the subduction process.
Can you estimate how much carbon you need to do that?
Yeah, we did calculate the carbon concentration. So in the lower mantle, we have on average 300 to 600 ppm of carbon based on our flux calculation, Dasgupta et al. So if you had that much carbon and you put it into iron, so you end up with a few percent of carbon. This is comparable to the eutectic composition of the iron-carbon binary system. And we still don't know exactly. So in the ballpark range, this is feasible. So the carbon, the effect of carbon is mainly to reduce the melting point so that you could get down. And another effect is the iron carbon melt, the wetting behavior might be very different from other type of melt.
One more question. So you assume that the temperature is homogeneously distributed in the mantle at a given depth. What if it's not? What you have lateral?
It's not. Actually, I think that another feature of this model is it's not sensitive to temperature, because if you look at this one, this relationship, but this might be an artifact. Okay, so it's this one here. If you look at where it crosses, it's really dictated by this very huge increase, right? The mantle temperature over here is going to be very low for, so that the eutectic point is above this one. It's not going to melt within most of the mantle. It's only at the base of the mantle it's going to melt. And if you have some variation over here, it's still going to cross. Because you always, as long as you have this thermal boundary layer with very steep temperature gradient, you'll be able to produce melt there. And given that this one is significantly lower than pure iron, and then here you are constrained by iron in the core being molten, I think you have a good chance of producing melt without being sensitive to the details of the geotherm.
But you're assuming
an adiabat, right? Here is the adiabat, yes. And here you have the thermal boundary layer. And that's a crossing. In fact, this is constrained by a post-bridge mag transition. So there are still some uncertainty over here, but I think the model is not particularly sensitive to that part. Adiabat. It's not very sensitive to the assumption of adiabat because you can have some room to change things over here. It's not, even if you melt this entire thing over here, because it's denser, it's probably going to drain and collect near the base of the mantle. I think it's not particularly sensitive, but it definitely would have an impact if you really move the adiabat or the potential temperature significantly. The adiabat itself, probably not very much.
So in your final cartoon, do you also have a specific thought about what the LSVP is? So that also enriched in metallic?
LSVP.
Yeah, it's in between the slab and the ultra-low velocity zone, and it has...
This model, we had some discussion with Ming and Alan, you know, about looking at up their papers. I think, you know, when we drew this cartoon, we went through many versions trying to be consistent with geodynamics. And at this point, my understanding is because the location, the relative location of UOVZ and LSVP, they're not well constrained. Just there's a general association. So we're putting it here, but they don't have a real meaning, I think. We don't really know where it occurs. Maybe around the edge is more likely because the slabs needs to bring things over here. And then the process, through the dynamic process, you have to be able to concentrate these things where temperature is relatively high. It's more likely for things to concentrate where it's a little bit higher. But probably that goes back to, you know, the mantle temperature, where why it matters.
Can you explain the slide that you skipped over? The implications for mixing of the light veneer?
Right. The implication for mixing. Okay, so I went in the wrong direction. So this is from geochemical study showing that this is one of the highly solidified elements. We see a evolution of this abundance. There was an increasing and reaching a steady, more or less constant value over here. So this might be, as we understand, it could probably indicate a progressive mixing of the late veneer. And in order to mix the late veneer, you need some kind of mechanism to bring the siderophile element down. And if you have this iron-carbon mixture, because it's iron-rich, the siderophile elements would like to go with it. So this is a mechanism to bring things down from the shallow depths into the deep mantle and homogenize this thing. Maybe it shows that a time that you do this over a certain time and finally reach a steady state, you're no longer, the mixing is more or less complete.
But you're producing the iron throughout Earth history. It's not primordial iron, I guess.
Primordial iron,
I mean,
means,
it's not,
that's right, yes.
So
yes.
You're producing that iron throughout Earth history, so I don't really understand. I mean, if
once you produce that iron, so if you had siderophile elements, this iron would be able to basically scavenge the siderophile elements and bring it down so that it gets mixed into the mantle. Because otherwise, you still need a mechanism, right, to mix the late veneer, which is a very small fraction, 0.5%.
Okay. You said that you can form this metallic alloy from 250 kilometers depth, and when you show the adiabat and the melting curve of the alloy,
yes,
it crosses again at the lowest pressures.
That's right.
Yeah. So, is it possible that we have melt?
There was already a study showing that you could have iron nickel sulfur melt at the lower depths through this kind of process. It's totally possible. Yes.